Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the graveyard shift. I know we're all that stands between you and probably some pretty ordinary champagne. So I'm hoping that this will be a bit of a lighter session than some you've had during the day. I'm Jane Gardner. I am a lawyer by background, and I worked as a lawyer in private practice for 27 years, and about 16 of those was as a partner in a national law firm. And I retired from the partnership about 5 years ago, and I now have a non-executive director career. So I'm down as the a non-executive director of State Cover Mutual, but I'm also a non-executive director of Arch LMI, and some of the Arch people are here, as are some of the State Cover people. I also chair a credit union, so I've got a lot of APRA exposure through those two insurers and the credit union. And I sit on a number of other boards in the health and university sectors mainly. So got quite a varied portfolio. This final plenary session will feature a discussion about the role of the CRO. Now, a number of you either work directly in the risk area of your organisation, or if you're actuaries, you'll either have a direct relationship with the CRO, or the work you do for an organisation, that request for work has often been initiated by the CRO area, and certainly any work as actuaries that you produce find their way back down to the CRO and used for risk analysis and risk ratings. So it's important that you have a good relationship with the CRO, and it's important that you know what a CRO is like, how they think, what their views are, and what they actually want from you. Our panel today is Matthew Wilson, Gavin Pearce, and Ben Gully. There's no one path to becoming recognised as a risk specialist, and this panel's been chosen specifically for that reason. They've got quite significantly different technical backgrounds, and they've also had experience in different jurisdictions. So we're going to hear a little bit about that and what their path to becoming a CRO has been, and how it's impacted on the way they conduct themselves. At the end of the session, probably like your other sessions, there's going to be an opportunity for questions, and there'll be a roving mic going round. And in my notes, it says to remind you there's a final opportunity for your questions to win you the mini iPad. So I'll be sitting down writing some really good questions while they're speaking. The first speaker is Matthew Wilson. He's a lawyer by background. He's a corporate lawyer and professional advisor in the fields of risk management, regulatory compliance, and corporate governance practice in the Australian and New Zealand financial services sector. And he's worked closely with boards of directors and operational teams as a chief legal officer and the chief risk officer. What a combination, the lawyer and risk. He's based in Sydney and maintains a keen interest in risk management practice and the financial services industry across the global economy, with particular focus on the Asian Pacific region, the UK and Europe. Matthew is CRO for a small APRA general insurer and a small life company, and holds various honorary roles as risk officer, including the Australian Hunter Horse Association and MMD Australia. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you, everybody. Jan, Jenny, the Institute, and everyone for staying for the graveyard shift. The role of the CRO, I could tell you that in probably a couple of words, is to know the outcome before it occurs, and then we can all go home now. That's one of my taglines. If you work with me, I don't like surprises, and I generally like to know where we're going and to consciously to take risks. So today what I'd like to do is, in the 10 minutes that I have, is go a little through about what you might find or the questions you might ask yourself when coming into an organisation or evaluating an opportunity in an organisation as a CRO. Going through a little bit of for an APRA Prudentially Managed Institute, and go through sort of what is the expectation of the CRO in the APRA space, And then to have a bit of a talk about some of the style of a CRO, what makes a good CRO, in my opinion, and some of the personal style, and why I think actuaries can make great CROs. So moving along. So I've been Chief Risk Officer now for probably almost 15 years. I've been in legal practice. Spent a lot of time doing risk management in legal practice. Lawyers like to know where the organisation is, what it's, what level of risk it's taking, and what particular outcomes we can achieve for the organisation. The one thing I found is that each organisation is really different. There's no one size that fits all. Every organisation has a different set of vision. It has a vision, its strategic purpose, its values in particular, what drives the people in the organisation, where it is in its journey and its strategy, and what is its culture DNA. Now, when I refer to that, I refer to what is the sum total of the accepted behaviours in the organisation that the leadership team will accept and will not accept in driving the business strategy. And this is a real area of focus for me for the last 4 years now, in working with an organisation that's invested very heavily in leadership. I believe that risk culture is not a bolt-on. Risk culture is really part of an extension of a very good business activity arising out of a very sound organisational culture. So the CRO is appointed by the board and reports to the CRO. That's very simple. It's a board appointment. Now, it is an officer appointment, so therefore you're an officer under the Corporations Act, and you're responsible as well for the failure of the organisation as an officer of the corporation. APRA sees it as a very important role because they've designated it as a prudentially mandated position for certain entities in Australia, such as banks, life companies, general insurance companies. So I'll get on to the three lines of defence because that'll do your head in. CRO and the risk management function is generally independent from the revenue and the operational parts of the business in line one. It sits in line two because it's required to really provide an advisory, measurement, monitoring, written review service, but you can actually still work with line one. So we don't sit in separate pillars of the building. We actually can work with line one as long as we stay genuine to our function in line two. And that's where advocacy comes in. So in my experience, the CRO leads the way for risk-taking right across the organisation. So we bring our organisational business owners on a journey that says, this is how much risk the board says you can take across the business. If it's not clear how much risk you can take, well, let's work out how much risk you can take and take it back to the board, or better articulate it in the day-to-day activities you do across the organisation. That's engagement. That's a lot of work because it's not just getting a policy and lobbing it over the fence and sending it down to the business. It's actually working with the business, staying true to the discipline of line two, but bringing them on the journey. That's hard work. Very much got to be engaged with the organisational culture. So that's the beliefs, the values and the leadership behaviours that we will tolerate as an organisation, and that's what sits right there with your risk culture. So I always call it culturing people for risk culture. So I get to understand how the organisation thinks and believes and breathes, and then I take them on the risk journey so they can become very informed risk takers right down in the front end of the business. Having said that, risk really comes from two places. Internally, what's happening at the strategy? Is there enough capability to support the strategy execution? And what about those little things that start at the front line of the business and percolate up into big issues? So it's really about getting people immersed in the risk culture, and it's that they all become risk managers. In fact, at EML, we refer to everybody as a risk manager. They get their regular newsletters, and we call them risk managers, not by designation or title, but just by what they do day to day. And we support them with the tools that they can do to report a risk, and we workflow it through to their business unit risk managers. Next three slides. My duty statement at EML, very much configured out of the APRA Prudential Standard. So when it came to CPS 220, like everyone else around town, we had a multidisciplinary risk, internal audit, company secretary, and legal practice. And God, it was efficient. And we were able to do it all in one place. The internal auditor had direct reporting lines to the board audit committee and to the CEO. The risk officer had the same. I thought it worked pretty well. And then we had to dismantle all that to go into CPS 220 and separate reporting lines of internal audit, risk, legal, and company secretarial. And it cost us more money to separate the lines to get within the three lines of defence. So like everyone else, we had the external review come through by one of the major accounting firms and tell us what we needed to do to implement the three lines of defence. So it's quite a big job when you look at the CROs, and we'll just quickly go through it. You actually got to design the risk management system for the organisation, and you got to do it within the tolerance set down by the board. You got to support the board in its obligations under the Prudential Standard. Really got to get close to the business and understand what the business is doing in terms of its strategy. You actually become the champions of risk decision making, so you've got to bring everybody along the journey of thinking things through with a reasonably disciplined mind and with measurement, particularly when a risk event occurs, and going as far to recommend the operational structure to your CEO. So at the CEO role, if you don't have the organisational capability, you're going to get operational failure. So it's your job to, in my opinion, to recommend the operational structure to the CEO. Of course, we all develop policies and protocols. We've got to make sure there's enough resources across business. And during the course of Q&A, we'll talk about the lines 1, 2 and 3 and how different organisations implement that. And really about the uncertainties. There's no certainty. Even though I said to you when I started, I'd like to know the outcome before it occurs, there's still a level of uncertainty, particularly with external events. So it's how you actually respond to those. You've also got responsibility for the internal control environment because that actually goes to risk and potentially to your capital. So you've got to oversight that as well. A lot of people will build internal controls just for the risk program. In fact, internal controls live out there in the operations of the business. So getting your head around those multiple dimensions is really no mean feat and a lot of hard work in my experience. I'll let you just read the last couple of points on this page. I think jumping down to ICAP, you really got to know the sensitivities of the organisation so that you can understand the stress points for stress testing, and also for what scenario is going to give the best value to the organisation to understand its vulnerabilities and the actions it needs to do to safeguard its capital position. So that all comes into the brief of the CRO. Also got to know when you're keeping true to what you say you're going to do. So you've got to have a repeatable risk cycle. A lot of that's just project management at the end of the day and keeping to timetable. So you've got to be pretty organised. You've also got to allow lots of independent eyes to come over what you do. I don't think I've ever seen a role, other than, say, the general insurance world where we used to have the external peer review actuary. So many eyes that go over a risk management framework. You've got your internal audit looking at it annually. You've got an external review every 3 years. And you've also got your performance review with the board. So it's one of those roles, in my experience, that has a lot of eyes coming from the assurance perspective. And you've obviously got to sign off the risk management declaration. The last point, probably the important one, is really getting into the business planning process of the organisation and understanding what does it want to do, where does it want to go, and does it really have the capability to manage the risks and generally to manage the organisation within the tolerance set down by the board. So that involves a lot of engagement in the strategic sessions of the business and also having a good conversation with the various business owners to understand how they're going to implement the strategy. Is it reasonably capable of implementation is really what the call you need to make. And if you don't think that you're satisfied that they can do that, well, you've got to have the further conversation and make the further investigations. Right. Let's move on. Useful skill sets for the CRO. I'll just move on to that now. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about why actuaries and other professionals make good CROs, and I'll be finished in about another 2 minutes. I think at the end of the day, all roads lead to the money. So that's why actuaries, I think, make really good CROs, because they can understand the financial gymnastics that a lot of other people probably don't understand. I've been fortunate because as a lawyer, as general counsel and senior legal counsel, I've actually worked closely with actuaries now for over almost 30 years. So I've reported, I had the unique situation when I was at ING reporting to the AA for many years. I've worked for many AAs in the risk role in life companies and financial services houses around town. So you actually learn a lot about the way actuaries look at things in relation to modelling and stressing and scenarios and just the general way in which these organisations are run financially. So whilst I would not be a rocket scientist on the math side, I'm reasonably numerate. I can understand long tail insurance, and also think about the when it comes to my ICAP, what are the stresses I want to see stressed out and then played out in the scenario to give me the comfort level that I can go to the board with when they look at their capital position. The one thing I've learned in the last 4 years is that you come to this job with who you are, your DNA, your personality, and your style, and you learn a lot about human behaviour and drivers, and the impact that you can have in this role on others, either positively or negatively. And I think that's been one of the biggest learning curves for me, because as a lawyer, I was very cut and dry, quite razor sharp. And as a CRO, you've got to have a lot more soft skills to be able to work with people, but then you've also got to set the boundaries for them. So there'll be times in the business when I would set a direction to the business owners if I feel that a risk is not where I would like it to be, and that's the time they know, okay, we've got to stop and reassess the situation. So a lot of the work is done in that very collegiate and collaborative style, but staying true to line two. So you're independent, you can still have a smile on your face and not be everyone's best friend. So understanding human behaviour, because that's where, you know, organisations, I think most of organisations' capability and their end product is about 80% of it is what people do. And I think that's been a big learning for me, doing a lot of work in that area, in learning about psychology, working with psychologists, understanding things in terms of business change, business strategy, or where I had a particular event occurring in the business to understand how people might be thinking and how we might best approach the particular event that we had. Very much about working and coaching and mentoring and working with people and bringing them on the journey. So, you know, a lot of times you'll have a new person that comes into the organisation and it's your role to bring them up along the journey. So that's a lot of work, particularly if you have staff turnover. Objectivity during situational events, I think, comes from my training. My father was a court lawyer, taught us as kids not to panic. One of the things I learned there was to be really objective and the calm person during a situational event. Typically, these are external events that you haven't prepared for. And really accepting that CRO duty statement, understanding what it really means for you to perform that duty statement. So those three slides back there, essentially what I've enumerated as I see as the CRO duty statement for an APRA-regulated institution. Maintaining your professional responsibility. So if you come to the CRO role as a professional, it's really important that you maintain those professional responsibility obligations that you have as a lawyer, as a actuary, or as an accountant. It's typically where a lot of the CROs come from. So I think actuaries and other professionals make great chief risk officers. Collectively, they provide a powerful and professional skill set, and that's what's really important in the CRO role, is that bringing the profession to the CRO role brings that level of recognition and respect to the role, and I think that's the differentiator when professional people come to the role. And I think this is my last slide. I think actuaries are great thinkers, and they get over the details, so they tend to be more what I call mind-based. They're good at getting to the bottom of things and the root cause analysis, and very good at the predictive and scenario stuff. They're very good at working with other people. Lawyers, we like to chat, so we tend to be a bit more heart-based. We tend to be good with words, and we understand legal risk. I think the other thing, that the last point, though, psychologists, they just know so much about humans and human behaviour. So if I was an actuary coming into a COO role, I'd make sure I was pretty well resourced up with a lawyer and a psychologist just to be able to understand that, even if it was just really for my own personal development, because I've learnt so much in the journey that I've had in leadership over the last 4 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Did you notice how he got you in really quickly by starting off saying actuaries are going to make great CROs? Then you were with him the whole way then, weren't you? The next speaker is Gavin Pearce, and his background is that he is an actuary. He joined iCare, which some of you would still know as WorkCover, in November as their inaugural Chief Risk Officer. Gavin's part of iCare's executive team, and he manages the risk and governance functions, including risk, compliance, audit and legal. Prior to joining iCare, Gavin was the Chief Risk Officer at Zurich Financial Services, Australia Limited. He's also held senior actuarial positions in a number of large insurance companies. He moved to Australia in 2008, and prior to that, he was the Accident Compensation Corporation in New Zealand's Chief Actuary, so he's had some experience in other jurisdictions. He holds a Master's degree in Statistics from the University of Waikato, an MBA from Henley Management College in the UK, and is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries in Australia. So he has quite a varied list of qualifications as well. Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks very much, Jen. Actually, that's most of my presentation done, so I can probably sit down again. Now, having done a presentation skills course, someone said if you can't be insightful or entertaining, then be quick. So I have one slide, and I will be very quick. When asked to talk at the seminar, what I was asked to do was briefly sort of talk a bit about my background and qualifications and how I saw those as being benefits in my current role as CRO. Probably the main thing for me really is the diversity of my background. So I started off in life insurance back in Wellington in 1992 for a company called Tower. Actually, between a couple of roles there, spent 8 years in life insurance before moving into workers' comp. And in total, spent about 9 years in working in workers' comp, accident comp organisations. I've had a 3.5 year stint at a commercial general insurance company. 2 years in a consulting firm, which was about 23 months too long. June, I won't say who it is. You can see it on my LinkedIn profile. In June of 2014, I was quietly sitting there minding my own business and got approached by a recruiter saying, have you thought about getting into risk management? And of course, being the risk-averse actuary that I was at the time, I said, well, yes, I have, but I'm not sure I'm ready for it. I probably need another year or two. Turns out that Zurich was looking for a new chief actuary. They wanted someone that could grow into the role rather than hit the ground running. And they were looking for someone with an actuarial background, which was exactly my strengths or relative weaknesses. So that was all fine. Apart from the one risk management slip-up I had at the time, we had some friends around for dinner on the Saturday before I was to start work at Zurich on the Monday. And, of course, my wife and her usual entertaining self sort of was talking to the wife of this couple and said, Gavin's starting work on Monday at Zurich as their chief risk officer. He's got no idea what he's doing. The wife happened to be Kate Bible from APRA. needless to say, I felt a little bit nervous about that one. But anyway, I lasted there for a year and a half before again being tapped on the shoulder to be asked if I'd be the CRO for the largest insurance company in Australia. Of course, I was thinking IAG, Suncorp, QBE. No, it turns out it's Insurance and Care New South Wales, or iCare, which was established on the 1st of September last year, so we've just had our first birthday. So technically, we're a $32 billion startup. But what I've found since moving to iCare is that no two CRO roles are the same. At Zurich, as you could imagine, being a Swiss-based company and having a local, regional and global infrastructure, we had what was often referred to as the Rolls-Royce of the risk management framework. Everything that could be there was there. We had a very detailed ERM system that you could tap into globally. Moving to iCare, The great opportunity there was to start with a completely blank sheet of paper. There was nothing. There was no risk appetite statements. There was no risk registers of any great depth or detail. And certainly from what I had at Zurich to what I found at iCare, I think it created a lot of it has created a lot of opportunity for me. In terms of Jan talked through the qualifications, so I won't go there too much with that. Only to say that when I did do an MBA, which was about 2003, I deliberately chose to do a dissertation in something that was completely non-financial and had near enough to no numbers in it, and that was actually looking at employee motivation. And the reason I did that was, I already had a statistics degree, an actuarial qualification, and I wanted to do something that kind of counterbalanced all of that left brain kind of analytical stuff. So, that to me was my first foray into trying to, break out of the actuarial mold, if you like. Some of the benefits, I think, of my background, experience, qualifications, and all the rest of it, probably first and foremost was my upbringing in New Zealand, growing up in a small town. And really, I think just being firmly sort of, feet planted on the ground. Actually, I remember the interview that I had at Zurich, and I was interviewed by the two CEOs of the Life and the GI company and the head of HR. And they said, what's the one attribute that you think will make you succeed as a CRO? And I said, humility. And that was it, one word. And I think for me that's the thing is, someone once said, there are no stupid questions, just stupid people. And I think for me the stupidest people are the people that don't ask any questions. So I think, quite often I'll pull out the, I'm a Kiwi or I'm an actuary, so this may be a dumb question. One of the things that really gets up my nose is TLAs, three-letter acronyms. So whenever there is an acronym, in a report, you get IT people and they just roll off the tongue. They can speak in volumes of just acronyms. I'm always the one that's, what does that mean? And for me, that's that inquisitive mind and, not the person that sits there trying to pretend they know everything, because I don't. My wife often tells me that. but that's the thing, I think, part of that benefit of just having that, a bit of an overarching understanding of how an insurance company works, being a bit of a jack of all trades. And as someone once said, as a CRO, I'm the news reader, not the news maker. So I'm not expected to know all of the detail that made the news, but I'm the one that needs to raise the flag with the board or the risk committee and then point the finger at... No. but it's surprising how often you get into those circumstances where I had a situation once where I was presenting to the board and, we had our strategic risk register and, the chairman of the board said, this one up here, Gavin, what are you doing about that? I was like, excuse me, what am I doing about that? Here's your CEO, talk to them. And it is quite easy how people sort of fall into that trap of, you are the CRO, and so therefore you manage risk. And really, we don't. For me, the major function of the CRO is to support the business in the achievements of its objectives. And you can slice and dice that way any way you like. But the three most important things from my perspective as a CRO is people, people, and people. You can talk about process, you can talk about systems, but processes are followed and designed or not by people. Systems are implemented or not by people. And so for me, it is about the culture of the organisation. I think APRA has done a slight disservice in focusing on risk culture. As I say, what gets measured gets done. We've heard about cultural surveys, risk culture surveys. And that reminded me of a book that I once read. I've only ever read two. It was a book called How to Think Like a Freak. It's the third in the series of the Freakonomics books. And one of the articles was about a game of soccer or football, depending on which country you come from. And when a goalkeeper's standing there and a player is taking a penalty kick, statistically speaking, the goalkeeper, best chances of preventing the goal is to stand perfectly still. But if they do, and the ball happens to go slightly left or right and they miss it, they look like a complete idiot. So they have to be seen to be doing something. And I think that's the risk that we run as a CRO is, if we fall into that trap of having to be seen to be doing something rather than actually stopping and thinking what is the best thing to do for the organisation. So I'll leave you with that.
Thanks, Gavin. Our final speaker has quite a different background again. He, Ben Gully, is an economist. He's APRA's Chief Risk Officer. In that role, Ben's responsible for promoting organisational effectiveness through a range of functions, including risk management, quality assurance, and strategy and performance. The role's new for APRA, and it's a key focus to promote independent oversight over APRA's business operations, consistent with those risk management expectations set out for regulated entities. So it seems like APRA's aligning itself with the expectations it has on the organisations over which it has regulatory authority. Prior to joining APRA in 2015, Ben worked with the Office of Superintendent of Financial Institutions in Canada for 14 years, and his most recent role there was Head of Large Bank Supervision, where he was responsible for leading the risk assessment on Canada's largest financial institutions. And that would have been around GFC time too. Ben started his career in the financial stability area at the Bank of England and holds a PhD in economics from the University of St Andrews, Scotland. So again, qualifications from around the world and experience from other jurisdictions. So welcome, Ben.
Oops, great. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I'm still relatively new to Australia, so it's great to be able to get out and meet people around and understand, obviously, some of the local conditions that you're all confronted with. Today's material will be a little different from my colleagues. This is a new role, the CRO at APRA, and it's a relatively rare role for regulators globally. I think there's only a handful of us. The US OCC and the UK PRA have similar roles, but generally this is still a new area of development, certainly for regulatory organisations. So what I wanted to do was talk a bit about the business of APRA. You've heard a lot today about the importance of knowing what the business is in order for CROs to be able to contribute meaningfully. And APRA does have a business model, and the context for risk management, I think, is important to go through. So I'll go through that. And then I'll talk more broadly about CRO capabilities, how I think it links to effectiveness, and then some comments on trends that I think will be important in understanding the role of the CRO and risk management in particular. It's a little content heavy, and I'm going to canter through because I have strict time restrictions, but hopefully you'll get the main messages. So my own background is economics, and that's a humbling place to be because you're the butt of a lot of jokes because no two economists can agree on their forecasts, and also because you realize actually your own work, no matter how well researched, is only one perspective, and the importance of getting different views and inputs and the diversity of thinking around that is key. So that background, I think, has been useful for me, particularly as I've moved into international work, particularly financial regulation and supervision, risk assessment, the GFC, and the whole process about recognizing how limited knowledge we hold in ourselves and the need to obviously reach out and build networks and leverage the information that you have. And thankfully, within the regulatory community, there is a well-established international network that we can lean upon, particularly in times of crises, but in BAU as well, and that is critical. We talked about my work in Canada on the business, as it were, of supervision. The one thing I will say from that, 3 years ago I was involved with the Financial Stability Board in drafting their guidance on risk culture. It was an early paper, 2014. I recommend that you have a look at that if you haven't already seen it. But really was an opportunity to think about how risk culture could be thought about in a regulatory setting. And indeed, we did some pilot work with a couple of financial institutions, which was illuminating. So I think the experience has hopefully set me up for a contribution to APRA. So what is APRA? There are many views of APRA, I'm sure, but the business model has been published in our corporate plan and strategy, and that is on our website. But essentially, we have a mandate, a mission, which is to enforce practices and standards to ensure under reasonable conditions financial promises that entities make are met within a safe and competitive marketplace. And we do this through three core functions: supervision, policy, and resolution. You can think of supervision as focusing on the probability of default, So all the work around risk assessment, the going concern, we're looking at understanding what that PD is and managing that. Resolution is the loss given default, so the gone concern. What happens if an institution fails? And we don't guarantee a zero failure regime. So if an entity fails, minimizing those losses. So going concern, gone concern. And in the middle, obviously, is policy, establishing, obviously, the prudential framework within which our supervisors operate. We have capabilities as well. And really, we only have two key assets at APRA, our people and the information that we manage. And so the people capabilities, the infrastructure and the processes we use to leverage the information and bring people together is informing their views is key. This slide says, what is APRA's risk universe? My role is primarily inward looking. It's looking at APRA's operational risks, which I'll talk about. But we're not in a vacuum here. And actually, this graphic really tries to illustrate that the business of APRA is risk management. And if you will, I'm the second line, so I'm interested in the risk management of the risk management business. And that sets up a very interesting dialogue with the front line, because they come in automatically with a view that we're interested in this, we're aligned, we have that view. So thinking about the risks that they take is important, but is unique and challenging. But we obviously have to think about the entity risks, that's the primary focus, but the context, the industry, the macro, the financial system, and obviously how things are changing over time. And the shared risks are the key for us, obviously, to think about. So those would be clearly financial stability, the risks posed to stability and what we're involved in there. So what are our operational risks? Our operational risks relate to our core output, and our output are judgments, prudential judgments and opinions about the safety and soundness of financial institutions. That comprises culture, processes, information, talent, RAS, bringing those together, because what we're trying to mitigate is flawed judgment and flawed action or inappropriate action and response. So the question a supervisor is continually trying to answer is, how much is enough? How much time, how much effort, and is our response, is our intervention appropriate or inappropriate? And if we get that wrong, we know there are serious implications. Too much, too little. So that is the key for us, sound prudential judgments. And understanding the risks to that defines our operational risk. So the context, why risk management focus at APRA when our business is risk management? Well, there's a few points here. First, the external environment continues to shift for regulators, prudential regulators globally. The GFC pointed fingers very much at financial institutions, but they also pointed fingers at regulators. And there is still, I think, even today, a debate to which rules versus supervision and risk management, the balance between the two can play. And indeed, the role of supervisors, the amount of trust that can be placed on them versus tangible things like capital, I think continues to be an active debate. So we need to recognize that and recognize that credibility is key. The second area for financial institutions, the GFC flagged the point that risk management, indeed the CRO, where the role existed, had not got the visibility it deserved, had not got the voice, had not been able to challenge, had not been able to flag issues that, with hindsight, were certainly ones that we would have thought could have been raised. And the capabilities weren't there, either the resources, the funding, the stature, and the access to the board. So a trend there. And then for APRA itself, it's come out with CPS 220, and a desire to make sure that what's good for industry should be good for itself, recognizing its size and complexity. So overall, there's a lot of drivers here for even greater focus on risk management and operational risk. I want to back out now just briefly on the CRO capabilities and what makes it effective. I've got some hexagons here in terms of areas or key areas of interest, but clearly the embedding and making it real and resonating with the business is key. This is not an academic exercise. These are not tools that sit on the left-hand side. These have to resonate. These have to be meaningful, and if they're not, then we need to change what we're doing. We need to think about the soft and the hard, and again, we've heard a lot about that today, but the culture is key. Knowledge of business is key, but the knowledge of the culture is key. If you cannot influence and engage the culture, you will fail. Effective oversight, the blind spots, I think you do need to be thick-skinned. You want to be empathetic because you want to engage, you want people to speak to you, but you have to be able to hold a line, and that's often a conflicting set of attributes. Often not an easy one to balance, because you want to challenge, you want to identify those blind spots, but you also need to maintain credibility and relationship management. In the last few minutes, a few comments on trends that I think are important for the CRO role. And they're important for me, but by the nature of the risk environment that we're confronting externally, may well be relevant more broadly. Org culture and softer aspects of driving risk management effectiveness. In risk management, you talk about the characteristics and the performance driving effectiveness. At CPS 220 and generally, there's been a lot of discussion on the characteristics of risk management, how it's structured in the organization, who it reports to, the funding, the authorities, the types of reporting, all very important. But the effectiveness, in my mind, goes to the softer aspects, and the culture elements are key. Emotional intelligence or organizational EQ, understanding the beat and the pulse, is core to that, in my view. Nurturing risk intelligence and big data. There's a lot of information coming down. That's great. New KPIs, new KRIs. The velocity of risk, though, is changing. And indeed, the drive to more automation and the use of AI poses new risks, new challenges. And Kathy O'Neill at Harvard refers to weapons of math destruction. And I think it's an instructive phrase, because new bias, new risks can manifest themselves, particularly around the opacity of some of these tools that we're looking to leverage. So opportunity, but definitely potential new health warnings. There are new risks to consider and manage. Well known to us, information security, cyber disruption, model risk. But the broader macro focus, I think, is important. We're all increasingly connected, whether we like it or not. And I think thinking about those shared risks is ultimately going to be a very important mitigant against the new challenges that confront us. Cyber is a great example. We have a public interest in cooperating and working together on cyber threats. And indeed, we've seen that build up over time across the official sector and with entities. Another area relates to talent. If we're going to be able to continue to be relevant and meaningful and effective, we better be able to be sure to attract the right talent. Those skills are changing rapidly. And indeed, that's something that I think really is going to be key. Can we continue to attract the people with not only the technical, but the behavioral skills? And that's a very rare combination. And then finally, the policy setting regime. We know APRA in setting policy has implications clearly, but more broadly, the political regime and the policy setting regime is going to be a very important trend. And as I said, there is this very active debate between how much rules versus judgment and discretion, that balance is appropriate over time. So to sum up, 4 points. From my perspective, the CRO role is a fascinating opportunity to look right across the organization, and going from the business of regulation and supervision into the second line has been a great opportunity to understand the theory and practice of independence. But certainly the risk profile needs to continue to remain for risk management within the organization, and we need to continue to work on that visibility to promote a sound financial system. The range and depth of capabilities are changing rapidly, so we need to think about our talent management strengths and the threats to credibility and performance. We have lots of things to be worried about, lots of data, lots of information. So maintaining focus and seeing that priority is going to be even greater going forward. And finally, cooperation. We need to recognize the shared risk intelligence and the need for us to coordinate in promoting a safe and sound financial system. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. I'll just invite the three speakers to come and sit at the front for the Q&A session. And if I can just remind you, this is the last chance to get that iPad. So has anyone got any questions? Perhaps if you just state your name and then ask some questions. Thank you.
Tabby Ventroni, the National Disability Insurance Agency. The strong theme today has been around the stage of culture, and I think I'd love to hear from the panel. In an agency such as ours, which has really got rapid growth and will have to sustain rapid growth across a number of years, how do we get ahead of the growth to influence culture? Is it, and I know there's no real magical formula, but in your experience, it's about a wheel that's square, as to the earlier slide, and how do we get people to sort of slow down and have to influence their thinking around risk when it's such a high growth period?
Okay, this goes to try to embed that culture into the organisation. So
happy to take that one. So back to the spring one, actually a rapidly growing organisation, you're probably in a better position than a state organisation. The hardest thing to do is to change culture. I liken it to trying to change habits. I think it was Mark Twain that once said, giving up smoking is the easiest thing in the world, I've done it so many times. So I think when you're trying to change culture in a rapidly growing organisation, if you are clear about your purpose and if you are clear about what you want your culture to look like, as a good starting position, and from a practical perspective, what we've done at iCare is use the Johnson and Scholes cultural web. If you have a look at that, it talks about, I think it's 6 or 8 attributes of a culture, and it talks to stories, rituals, symbols, your organisational structure, your power structures. And if you run around the web and sort of say, well, okay, what do we want our organisation to look like from those different attributes, that's a good starting point. And then I think it's through the recruitment process, hiring the right people, not just those that are technically able to do the jobs that you need filled, but also fit with the culture of the organisation. And again, that's something we've done at iCare. We've turned away candidates because they just don't fit with our culture. And I think, treasure your culture because that is very valuable.
Just to build on that, I think the brand and the values of the organisation are key, and the leadership are very much going to be driving that. So some organisations, you can sort of almost taste that branding and that culture and those corporate values. And so the question is, before that growth commences, is the organisation really clear on what those values are and the symbols and how they're being transmitted? Because as I think the term earlier, the culture carriers, you want everyone ultimately to convey and promote and build those values, and that I think speaks to clarity up front. It'll be clear everyone understands what our corporate ethos is.
Just to build on that, having been in an organisation that revisited its values, you engage the people to select the values of the organisation. You actually go through and engage the workforce and get them to provide you with the input into the value of the organisation, and then it's about determining behaviours that you'll accept, because the behaviours go to leadership and to culture. And one way we do it at EML, everyone at EML gets to meet the exec team when they come into the organisation. They get a full induction program. And they also get a little book called a little risk book, which goes through and talks a lot about the standard type of behaviour and the way they respond in the workplace to workplace events. So it's really about really engaging with them on the journey through all functions in the organisation with the very, very same clear message, obviously coming straight back to support your vision.
Thank you. Yes, further question at the back here.
Thank you. Ben Wilden from RSA. Matthew, I like your idea about the book of risk booklets prior to someone joining the organisation and setting clear expectations. But questions for Ben Gully. You know, in one of your slides, you mentioned embedding an ownership by the business of risk. What are some of the key activities that APRA have been doing, you know, to embed and create that ownership throughout the organisation?
So, first point for APRA is the business is about risk management. So, the key operational risks are for us areas where judgments and opinions are not subject to as much challenge or debate or diversity of thinking as we would expect to see. So setting up the conversations and the engagements around core decision-making processes that we have at APRA and making sure that they are subject to a diversity of thinking around that has been key. Obviously, working closely with them, being part of those discussions, either with respect to individual risks or more broadly in terms of broader macro thematic risks, but very much being at the table of those discussions and challenging ourselves on where the blind spots are and making sure we're aware of the opportunity to seek additional input or outside views. So the embedding is very much about challenging the status quo. And so and making sure that we're consciously aware of it. So we now do conscience reports at the end of each meeting. How do we do? Were there areas where we could have sought more advice or areas that we perhaps dismissed too readily? Would be the interactions, I think, will be central.
I shall ask the others to comment too, because embedding risk culture is a really big issue at the moment. APRA's focus has moved off the sort of the more compliant side of risk and looking much more at risk culture, and trying to embed that through the organisation is a real difficulty, particularly for well-established organisations. So I'll ask the other two to comment on that as well.
Just to pick up on the paper we did for FSB in 2014, we talk about four areas, which I think also will partly answer the question. Tone from the top. So in what way are the messages that are coming from the top of the organization down reinforcing a risk view? We talk about incentives. So in what way, yes, there's remuneration, which is an obvious one, but talent and succession development. Do people see going to the CRO or the risk area as an opportunity to build and progress their career or a cul-de-sac? We have areas around communication. In what way are those espoused values getting out there and engaged? And incentives and very much around the opportunity to step back and get different views and perspectives. So that paper, I think, will also be quite helpful to you in that regard.
As I sort of alluded to earlier, I actually want to try and get rid of the word risk. And not talk about risk culture and just talk about the culture of the organisation. And even moving ahead to the risk management, I certainly like the comments that David made earlier about, you know, risk, whilst in theory it's about uncertainty of outcome, there is a very sort of downside risk focus to risk management. And at the moment we talk about risks, we need to talk about controls, which also have this negative connotation. So very much the, you know, what must go right rather than thinking of the things that could go wrong. And also that the statement around the fact that, you know, the biggest risk is the risk of doing nothing. And if you drive innovation out of the organisation or stifle it, I think that's a big risk. So then getting on to culture, you know, one of the people I work very closely with in our organisation is the general manager, executive general manager of people engagement, which is our Trinity Word for HR. And so we work quite closely together. We're now called the twins, and we're one of the theme movie twins. Our 5'5" bald-headed head of people engagement insists he's the Arnold Schwarzenegger on the Danny DeVito, so delusions of adequacy, I think. But yeah, it's that working on a culture of the organisation to embed it and having people do the right thing at the right time for the right reason, which then gets me on to, it's all about alignment of purpose, alignment of values, alignment of motivations. You know, don't expect someone to be customer-centric and then motivate them to have high sale volumes. You just, it won't work. So you've got to have a complete alignment across the organisation. And the other thing with culture that gets me is usually any conversation around culture, within 30 seconds, we're talking about behaviours.
behaviors you can see, culture you can't, by its definition. This is things that people do when you're not looking. So for me, someone said, you know, would you rather, in a driving analogy, would you rather have good drivers or good roads? And I'd rather have a good driver. And I don't care if you're a speed freak, but, you know, I want to know that when they come to an icy road that they will slow down and then they can speed up again later. So for me, it's getting the right behaviours.
Thank you. I think starting point is to get insight in what your people are thinking. And the only real way to do that is to ask them. And that starts with a, I think, comprehensive employee engagement survey that really gets into their minds and gives you insights into what they're thinking about the organisation, its reward systems, how well they can raise issues across the organisation. It's actually a really good starting point because you learn a lot about what the people are thinking and what the organisation engagement looks like. And from there, you can almost break it down by different parts of the organisation and get an understanding of it. Once you can do that, you can look at, well, what do you need to do as a leadership team to actually address it to where you want to be as an organisation? On the risk-taking side of things, it's really about educating people at the front line of the business of what tolerance that you have for them or what tolerance there is available for them to take risks. So, to give you an example, we love innovation, but an individual person can't go out and do something without conformance to our standard business system unless it goes through a proper change process. So we say, yes, please go into the alert risk system and report an idea, and then it will be progressed by the risk manager sitting within your business unit to work with you to raise it as a good idea right up through the CEO and the senior leadership team. So it's about trying to keep it simple so that you can keep an end-to-end view on things, but it really comes down to what the people are thinking in the organisation is my view and my experience of what drives risk culture from culture. So I say culturing people for risk culture. And I think my job as a CRO is to make sure that people understand what are the acceptable tolerances that we have for people across the organisation in relation to their decisions, in relation to how they conduct themselves. That actually is a pretty good place to be, because if you do that across every single person in the workforce, what I do is I then go through and this is quite operational, I suppose, but it's how I've seen it work, is to actually give them scenarios, and then they have to do their testing every year. And I change scenarios around with the risk community at EML, and they all have to do their scenario test. So you actually get them to understand how they need to respond in front-end business situations. So rather than do testing of just purely factual stuff, they've got to think about what it is, and their information guide is contained in their induction and their ongoing training materials. So it's a lot of work, but it seems to get a pretty good risk culture. In our last employee engagement survey, we got very, very good feedback on culture because people understood the amount of risk-taking that they could take. They indicated to us they wanted to know a bit more about the top-line risks in the organisation. That was something that we took on board, but there was a really good culture of transparency. So these types of measures are usually quite useful. They're not quick wins, though. They take a couple of years to actually embark on them, plan them, engage with everybody. There's a number of stakeholders, including the senior leadership team. Thank you.
Another question here.
Adam Sowell, KPMG. Actuaries historically have been almost exclusively involved in a small selection of industries, so banking, insurance, super, healthcare. A lot of the CRO roles, responsibilities, really don't seem to be tied to those industries in particular at all. Do you think there is a future somewhere down the track where actuaries, there'll be a mass deluge of them to manufacturing and to various other sort of industries where they'll be adopting a sort of CRO role?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I think no two CRO roles are the same, and I think no two CROs are the same, and I think it's very much a case of, you know, round peg, round hole. You know, there will be situations where someone that's not from non-financial services will want a CRO with the attributes of someone that looks like an actuary. Certainly, I was at a conference last week, and they had a risk manager in the project space at Downer presenting, and he was doing all this amazing analytical work to essentially drive out uncertainty in their estimates of project costs. Civil construction projects and something that sounded a lot like actuarial statistical analysis.
I just have a question from a board perspective. That APRA's is focusing more on risk culture, and the board's required to have oversight of that. And I'm just wondering how you demonstrate to a board that the risk culture, what it is to start with, and how you would report that the organisation has embedded it into their decision making. So what as a director, what am I going to see from you that gives me some sort of assurance that that risk culture is effective and designed to minimise the risks that are there in the business?
That's a question I'm grappling with at the moment.
which is why I asked it.
I think there's an element of, for me as a CRO, talking to the chairman of my risk committee, you've got to establish a relationship, and through that relationship comes trust. And so the chair of the risk committee, as at least the representative of the board in risk-related matters, he has to trust in me that I will come to him with whatever the issues or problems are. So when I tell him that things are going well, he believes that to some degree. And when they're not, that I will also raise that flag. Because otherwise you can just stand up there, and unless he's talked to Alan and done the analysis to tell him I'm lying, how do you know? You can see artifacts, and I think that's where CPS 220 has started. You need to have a risk management strategy document, you need to have a CRO, a risk function, a management information system. Those are necessary but not sufficient, but it's a good place to start. So I think having those in place and demonstrating you have those. But for me, one of the really basic fundamental elements is an incident reporting system and incidents being reported by the first line. It's just a really basic one. If that's happening, fantastic. If it's not, you've got problems. People are not prepared to put their hand up, and why that is, would be worth investigating.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to comment on that?
Sure. I think there's probably some kind of reporting ultimately that would be expected, and there's a range of indicia and information that should be able to be drawn upon. But I think your comfort should come from the ongoing engagements you have with management, the type of conversations that you're having. Is risk visible? What are the consequences when decisions don't go as planned, or indeed maybe some area goes outside the risk appetite? I think that's sort of providing a range of implicit indicators that the boards in particular have a unique vantage point over, that I think risk can help structure and highlight, but ultimately those cues are real time all the time. So it shouldn't be coming to the end of the year going, do we have a good risk culture? That should be something that you actually get some comfort from throughout the year. I think the focus on the formality of the products and the reporting is important, but ultimately it's that dialogue, that discussion, the nature of communication, the nature of leadership at the board meetings and beyond that is going to really give you that comfort that's expected.
I think needs to boards don't want to get operationally focused, but they want to get comfort that what's happening in the front line of business right now. And I think the only way you can really give them meaningful insights to some form of measurement. And the only one I've been able to come up with is some type of external engagement type questionnaire where you get an understanding of what people are thinking, what they think about. The things they do day to day, does that fit within the type of activities and actions that we want people to take in an organisation that's managing its risks soundly? And that's the only way I've been able to find that, other than asserting to the board that yes, these KRIs have been triggered this month and there was a surprise here. The board just went further and asked further questions, so we just built it into the engagement survey. That was the only way I could really get someone to assert to the board that
this is what people are thinking, and this is sort of what the risk sort of culture index sort of tracks to. And you've got other ways of doing it. So here at the Women's Premium Conference last year, I think Qantas presented their risk culture across their management team or the leadership team down to manager level. That gives some useful insights. A number of the professional firms also do a number of risk behavioural type surveys and shield stuff that give you those insights as well.
This is self-promotion, but obviously how firms respond to supervisory recommendations. but joking aside, although I would say that that is an area that when supervisors are thinking about risk culture, if there are recurring findings, then for sure that's a thing. But obviously within the organisation, how the business responds to internal audit and outstanding findings, I think is part of the big toolkit that indicates.
Actually, just on that point, I listened to a talk by a fellow from APRA last year, and he said that the response when APRA says they're coming to view your organisation ranges from abject terror to arrogant dismissal. They never know which one they're going to face. So. I'll wrap up the session because we do have further follow-up question. Sorry.
Just with the emergence of cyber risk and cyber threats as featured in some of your discussions, are you treating that any differently to any other risk that you've been managing for some time? Are you collaborating closer with the Chief Information Security Officer in your organisations to deal with that?
So yes and yes. Actually, it's much further beyond our immediate organisation and government agencies, both domestically and internationally. This is an area that is a known unknown. And we don't have the traditional knowledge sets to deal with it, so we very much need to lean upon other agencies and organisations to inform what we do, and there's a very active and important network to support that.
Practically, operationally, I spent 2 years working with an international underwriter to bespoke my policy terms for my cyber policy to get the exact manuscripted wording I needed to do the risk transfer in the event that I had cyber and I needed to actually transfer a heap of expertise and money into to do the cleanup. That's one aspect of the program. That's taken me about 2 years to get it all finalised in place, and when I got it in place, the board said, can you double the amount of cover you've got? So I took all the capacity out of the Australian market. For anyone else, we've found someone to follow the form. It is a difficult area because a lot of organisations are now moving outside the traditional firewalls of their own IT departments. It takes up an enormous amount of my time in the risk management department to consider when they want to go to another cloud-based provider, and also making sure that our prevention and our general capability in that area is adequate. To be able to put the organisation in the best place. But it's just, it's one area I suppose I have a little bit of fear on because it's almost criminal type activity. It's striking a lot of people. So yes, it's got a lot more presence in the last 2 years in our organisation between the risk department and the office of the CIO.
Yeah, for me, we've sort of brought about information security. I think I sort of saw or read somewhere that, information breaches, about 60% of them are from internal people, not external. So cyber risk in terms of that, someone sitting externally hacking into your systems, for us, it's kind of the least of our worries. It is the internal stuff. Yeah, and we only have to look to the unfortunate incident across the Tasman and ACC a few years ago as a major impact on reputation. So for me as a CRO, that's probably the key risk on our risk register is that information gets out there. I mean, we have a lot of personal information, health records. If they get out there, cyber assurance isn't going to help me. It's the resilience planning. It's the when, not if, and what we do about it.
Okay, thank you. I think that was a really interesting session, and for me, what I found was CROs are much more people focused, and you've got to have good people skills rather than just the black and white risk assessment skills. It seems that it's a much more people focused business or area in order to be successful. So very interesting. So join with me in thanking Matthew, Gavin and Ben.